and 10, staring out at him with greedy eyes. Each wore a small kinjal type of kris knife, rested a hand on the hilt. And Paul recalled the stories of the Fremen, that their children fought as ferociously as the adults.
The hands move, the lips move, ideas gush from his words, and his eyes devour. He is an island of selfdom. Description from Emmanuel of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
Phosphor tubes in the faraway upper reaches of the cavern cast a dim light onto the thronged interior, hinting at the great size of this rock-enclosed space. Larger, Jessica saw, than even the gathering hall of her Bene Gesserit school. She estimated there were more than 5,000 people gathered out there beneath the ledge where she stood with Stilgar. And more were coming. The air was murmurous with people.
"Your son has been summoned from his rest, Sayadina," Stilgar said. "Do you wish him to share in your decision?"
"Could he change my decision?"
"Certainly. The air with which you speak comes from your own lungs, but..."
"The decision stands," she said. But she felt misgivings, wondering if she should use Paul as an excuse for backing out of a dangerous course. There was an unborn daughter to think of as well. What endangered the flesh of the mother endangered the flesh of the daughter. Men came with rolled carpets, grunting under the weight of them, stirring up dust as the loads were dropped onto the ledge. Stilgar took her arm, led her back into the acoustical horn that formed the rear limits of the ledge. He indicated a rock bench within the horn.
"The Reverend Mother will sit here, but you may rest yourself until she comes."
"I prefer to stand," Jessica said. She watched the men unroll the carpets covering the ledge, looked out at the crowd. There were at least 10,000 people on the rock floor now, and still they came. Out on the desert, she knew, it already was red nightfall, but here in the cavern hall was perpetual twilight, a grey vastness thronged with people come to see her risk her life. A way was opened through the crowd to her right, and she saw Paul approaching, flanked by two small boys. There was a swaggering air of self-importance about the children. They kept hands on knives, scowled at the wall of people on either side.
"The sons of Jamis, who are now the sons of Usul," Stilgar said. "They take their escort duties seriously."
He ventured a smile at Jessica. Jessica recognized the effort to lighten her mood and was grateful for it, but could not take her mind from the danger that confronted her. "I have no choice but to do this," she thought. "We must move swiftly if we're to secure our place among these Fremen." Paul climbed up to the ledge, leaving the children below. He stopped in front of his mother, glanced at Stilgar, back to Jessica. "What is happening? I thought I was being summoned to council." Stilgar raised a hand for silence, gestured to his left where another way had been opened in the throng. Chaney came down the lane, opened there, her elfin face set in lines of grief. She had removed her stillsuit and wore a graceful blue wraparound that exposed her thin arms. Near the shoulder on her left arm, a green kerchief had been tied. Green for mourning, Paul thought. It was one of the customs the two sons of Jamis had explained to him by indirection, telling him they wore no green because they accepted him as guardian father.
"Are you the Lisan al-Ghaib?"
they had asked. And Paul had sensed the jihad in their words, shrugging off the question with one of his own, learning then that Caliph, the elder of the two, was 10, and the natural son of Jeff. Orlop, the younger, was 8, the natural son of Jamis. It had been a strange day with these two standing guard over him, because he asked it, keeping away the curious, allowing him the time to nurse his thoughts and prescient memories, to plan a way to prevent the jihad. Now, standing beside his mother on the cavern ledge and looking out at the throng, he wondered if any plan could prevent the wild outpouring of fanatic legions. Chaney, near the ledge, was followed at a distance by 4 women carrying another woman in a litter. Jessica ignored Cheney's approach, focusing all her attention on the woman in the litter, a crone, a wrinkled and shriveled ancient thing in a black gown with hood thrown back to reveal the tight knot of grey hair and the stringy neck. The litter carriers deposited their burden gently on the ledge from below, and Cheney helped the old woman to her feet. "So this is their reverend mother," Jessica thought. The old woman leaned heavily on Cheney as she hobbled toward Jessica, looking like a collection of sticks draped in the black robe. She stopped in front of Jessica, peered upward for a long moment before speaking in a husky whisper.
"So, you're the one?"
The old head nodded once precariously on the thin neck.
"The Shadout Mapes was right to pity you."
Jessica spoke quickly, scornfully. "I need no one's pity."
"That remains to be seen,"
husked the old woman. She turned with surprising quickness and faced the throng.
"Tell them, Stilgar."
"Must I?" he asked.
"We are the people of Mysr,"
the old woman rasped.
"Since our Sunni ancestors fled from Nilotek al-Ruba, we have known flight and death. The young go on, that our people shall not die."
Stilgar took a deep breath, stepped forward two paces. Jessica felt the hush come over the crowded cavern, some 20,000 people now standing silently, almost without movement. It made her feel suddenly small and filled with caution.
"Tonight we must leave this siege that has sheltered us for so long and go south into the desert,"
Stilgar said. His voice boomed out across the uplifted faces, reverberating with the force given it by the acoustical horn behind the ledge. Still the throng remained silent.
"The Reverend Mother tells me she cannot survive another Hajra," Stilgar said. "We have lived before without a Reverend Mother, but it is not good for people to seek a new home in such straits."
Now the throng stirred, rippling with whispers and currents of disquiet.
"That this may not come to pass," Stilgar said. "Our new Sayadina Jessica of the Weirding has consented to enter the rite at this time. She will attempt to pass within, that we not lose the strength of our Reverend Mother."
Jessica of the Weirding, Jessica thought. She saw Paul staring at her, his eyes filled with questions, but his mouth held silent by all the strangeness around them. "If I die in the attempt, what will become of him?" Jessica asked herself. Again she felt the misgivings fill her mind. Cheney led the old Reverend Mother to a rock bench deep in the acoustical horn, returned to stand beside Stilgar.
"That we may not lose all if Jessica of the Weirding should fail," Stilgar said. "Cheney, daughter of Liet, will be consecrated in the Sayadina at this time."
He stepped one pace to the side. From deep in the acoustical horn, the old woman's voice came out to them, an amplified whisper, harsh and penetrating.
"Cheney has returned from her Hajra. Cheney has seen the waters."
A susurrant response arose from the crowd.
"She has seen the waters."
"I consecrate the daughter of Liet in the Sayadina,"
husked the old woman.
"She is accepted,"
the crowd responded. Paul barely heard the ceremony, his attention still centered on what had been said of his mother.
"If she should fail?"
He turned and looked back at the one they called Reverend Mother, studying the dried crone features, the fathomless blue fixation of her eyes. She looked as though a breeze would blow her away, yet there was that about her which suggested she might stand untouched in the path of a Coriolis storm. She carried the same aura of power that he remembered from the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, who had tested him with agony in the way of the Gom Jabbar.
"I, the Reverend Mother Ramallo, whose voice speaks as a multitude, say this to you,"
the old woman said.
"It is fitting that Cheney enter this Sayadina."
"It is fitting,"
the crowd responded. The old woman nodded, whispered,
"I give her the silver skies, the golden desert and its shining rocks, the green fields that will be. I give these to Sayadina Cheney, and lest she forget that she's servant of us all, to her fall the menial tasks in this ceremony of the seed. Let it be as Shai-Hulud will have it."
She lifted a brown stick arm, dropped it. Jessica, feeling the ceremony close around her with a current that swept her beyond all turning back, glanced once at Paul's question-filled face, then prepared herself for the ordeal.
"Let the water masters come forward,"
Cheney said, with only the slightest quaver of uncertainty in her girl-child voice. Now Jessica felt herself at the focus of danger, knowing its presence in the watchfulness of the throng, in the silence. A band of men made its way through a serpentine path opened in the crowd, moving up from the back in pairs. Each pair carried a small skin sack, perhaps twice the size of a human head. The sacks sloshed heavily. The two leaders deposited their load at Cheney's feet on the ledge and stepped back. Jessica looked at the sack, then at the men. They had their hoods thrown back, exposing long hair tied in a roll at the base of the neck. The black pits of their eyes stared back at her without wavering. A furry redolence of cinnamon arose from the sack, wafted across Jessica. "The spice?" she wondered.
"Is there water?"
Cheney asked. The watermaster on the left, a man with a purple scar line across the bridge of his nose, nodded once.
"There is water, Sayadina," he said, "but we cannot drink of it."
"Is there seed?"
Cheney asked.
"There is seed," the man said.
Cheney knelt and put her hands to the sloshing sack.
"Blessed is the water and its seed."
There was familiarity to the rite, and Jessica looked back at the Reverend Mother Romalo. The old woman's eyes were closed, and she sat hunched over as though asleep.
"Sayadina Jessica,"
Cheney said. Jessica turned to see the girl staring up at her.
"Have you tasted the blessed water?"
Cheney asked. Before Jessica could answer, Cheney said,
"It is not possible that you have tasted the blessed water. You are outworlder and unprivileged."
A sigh passed through the crowd, a susurration of robes that made the nape hairs creep on Jessica's neck.
"The crop was large, and the maker has been destroyed,"
Cheney said. She began unfastening a coiled spout fixed to the top of the sloshing bag. Now, Jessica felt the sense of danger boiling around her. She glanced at Paul, saw that he was caught up in the mystery of the ritual and had eyes only for Cheney.
"Has he seen this moment in time?"
Jessica wondered. She rested a hand on her abdomen, thinking of the unborn daughter there, asking herself,
"Do I have the right to risk us both?"
Cheney lifted the spout toward Jessica, said,
"Here is the water of life. The water that is greater than water can, the water that frees the soul. If you be a reverend mother, it opens the universe to you. Let Shai-Hulud judge now."
Jessica felt herself torn between duty to her unborn child and duty to Paul. For Paul, she knew, she should take that spout and drink of the sack's contents. But as she bent to the proffered spout, her senses told her its peril. The stuff in the sack had a bitter smell, subtly akin to many poisons that she knew, but unlike them, too.
"You must drink it now," Cheney said.
"There's no turning back," Jessica reminded herself. But nothing in all her Bene Gesserit training came into her mind to help her through this instant.
"What is it?"
Jessica asked herself.
"A liquor? A drug?"
She bent over the spout, smelling the esters of cinnamon, remembering then the drunkenness of Duncan, Idaho.
"Spice liquor?"
she asked herself. She took the siphon tube in her mouth, pulled up only the most minuscule sip. It tasted of the spice, a faint bite acrid on the tongue. Janie pressed down on the skin bag. A great gulp of the stuff surged into Jessica's mouth, and before she could help herself, she swallowed it, fighting to retain her calmness and dignity.
"To accept a little death is worse than death itself," Janie said.
She stared at Jessica, waiting. And Jessica stared back, still holding the spout in her mouth. She tasted the sack's contents in her nostrils, in the roof of her mouth, in her cheeks, in her eyes, a biting sweetness now.
"Cool."
Again, Cheney sent the liquid gushing into Jessica's mouth.
"Delicate."
Jessica studied Cheney's face, elfin features, seeing the traces of Lietkynes there as yet unfixed by time.
"This is a drug they feed me,"
Jessica told herself. But it was unlike any other drug of her experience, and Bene Gesserit training included the taste of many drugs. Janie's features were so clear, as though outlined in light.
"A drug."
Whirling silence settled around Jessica. Every fiber of her body accepted the fact that something profound had happened to it. She felt that she was a conscious mote, smaller than any subatomic particle, yet capable of motion and of sensing her surroundings. Like an abrupt revelation, the curtains whipped away, she realized she had become aware of a psychokinesthetic extension of herself. She was the mote, yet not the mote. The cavern remained around her, the people. She sensed them, Paul, Cheney, Stilgar, the Reverend Mother Amalo.
Reverend Mother?
At the school there had been rumors that some did not survive the Reverend Mother ordeal, that the drug took them. Jessica focused her attention on the Reverend Mother Amalo, aware now that all this was happening in a frozen instant of time, suspended time for her alone.
"Why is time suspended?"
she asked herself. She stared at the frozen expressions around her, seeing a dust mote above Cheney's head, stopped there, waiting. The answer to this instant came like an explosion in her consciousness. Her personal time was suspended to save her life. She focused on the psychokinesthetic extension of herself, looking within, and was confronted immediately with a cellular core, a pit of blackness from which she recoiled.
"That is the place where we cannot look," she thought.
"There is the place the Reverend Mothers are so reluctant to mention. The place where only Kwisatz Haderach may look." This realization returned a small measure of confidence, and again, she ventured to focus on the psychokinesthetic extension, becoming a mote self that searched within her for danger. She found it within the drug she had swallowed. The stuff was dancing particles within her, its motions so rapid that even frozen time could not stop them. Dancing particles. She began recognizing familiar structures, atomic linkages, a carbon atom here, helical wavering, a glucose molecule. An entire chain of molecules confronted her, and she recognized a protein, a methyl protein configuration.
Ah!
It was a soundless mental sigh within her as she saw the nature of the poison. With her psychokinesthetic probing, she moved into it, shifted an oxygen mote, allowed another carbon mote to link, reattached a linkage of oxygen, hydrogen. The change spread, faster and faster as the catalyzed reaction opened its surface of contact. The suspension of time relaxed its hold upon her, and she sensed motion. The tube spout from the sack was touched to her mouth gently, collecting a drop of moisture. "Cheney's taking the catalyst from my body to change the poison in that sack," Jessica thought.
"Why?"
Someone eased her to a sitting position. She saw the old Reverend Mother Amalo being brought to sit beside her on the carpeted ledge. A dry hand touched her neck. And there was another psychokinesthetic mote within her awareness. Jessica tried to reject it, but the mote swept closer, closer.
They touched.
It was like an ultimate simpatico, being two people at once, not telepathy, but mutual awareness, with the old Reverend Mother. But Jessica saw that the Reverend Mother didn't think of herself as old. An image unfolded before the mutual mind's eye, a young girl with a dancing spirit and tender humour. Within the mutual awareness, the young girl spoke.
Yes, that is how I am.
Jessica could only accept the words, not respond to them.
You'll have it all soon, Jessica.
This is hallucination, Jessica told herself.
You know better than that. Swiftly now, do not fight me. There isn't much time. You should have told us you were pregnant.
Jessica found the voice that talked within the mutual awareness.
Why?
This changes both of you. Holy Mother, what have we done?
Jessica sensed a forced shift in the mutual awareness, saw another mote presence with the inward eye. The other mote darted wildly here, there, circling. It radiated pure terror.
You'll have to be strong. Be thankful it's a daughter you carry. This would have killed a male fetus. Now, carefully, gently, touch your daughter presence. Be your daughter presence. Absorb the fear. Soothe. Use your courage and your strength. Gently now. Gently.
The other whirling mote swept near, and Jessica compelled herself to touch it. Terror threatened to overwhelm her. She fought it the only way she knew. I shall not fear. Fear is the mind killer. The litany brought a semblance of calm. The other mote lay quiescent against her.
Words won't work, Jessica told herself.
She reduced herself to basic emotional reactions, radiated love, comfort, a warm snuggling of protection. The terror receded. Again, the presence of the old Reverend Mother asserted itself, but now there was a tripling of mutual awareness, two active and one that lay quietly absorbing.
Time compels me. I have much to give you, and I do not know if your daughter can accept all this while remaining sane. But it must be. The needs of the tribe are paramount.
What?
Remain silent and accept.
Experiences began to unroll before Jessica. It was like a lecture strip in a subliminal training projector at the Bene Gesserit school, but faster. Blindingly faster. Yet distinct. She knew each experience as it happened. There was a lover, virile, bearded, with the Fremen eyes, and Jessica saw his strength and tenderness, all of him in one blink moment, through the Reverend Mother's memory. There was no time now to think of what this might be doing to the daughter fetus, only time to accept and record. The experiences poured in on Jessica, birth, life, death, important matters and unimportant, an outpouring of single view time.
Why should a fall of sand from a clifftop stick in the memory? She asked herself.
Too late, Jessica saw what was happening. The old woman was dying, and in dying, pouring her experiences into Jessica's awareness as water is poured into a cup. The other mote faded back into pre-birth awareness as Jessica watched it. And, dying in conception, the old Reverend Mother left her life in Jessica's memory with one last sighing blur of words.
I've been a long time waiting for you. Here is my life.
There it was, encapsulated. All of it, even the moment of death.
I am now a Reverend Mother, Jessica realized.
And she knew with a generalized awareness that she had become, in truth, precisely what was meant by a Bene Gesserit Reverend Mother. The poison drug had transformed her. This wasn't exactly how they did it at the Bene Gesserit school, she knew. No one had ever introduced her to the mysteries of it, but she knew. The end result was the same. Jessica sensed the daughter mote still touching her inner awareness, probed it without response. A terrible sense of loneliness crept through Jessica in the realization of what had happened to her. She saw her own life as a pattern that had slowed, and all life around her speeded up so that the dancing interplay became clearer. The sensation of mote awareness faded slightly, its intensity easing as her body relaxed from the threat of the poison, but still she felt that other mote, touching it with a sense of guilt at what she had allowed to happen to it.
I did it, my poor, unformed, dear little daughter. I brought you into this universe and exposed your awareness to all its varieties without any defenses.
A tiny outflowing of love comfort, like a reflection of what she had poured into it, came from the other mote. Before Jessica could respond, she felt the adab presence of demanding memory. There was something that needed doing. She groped for it, realizing she was being impeded by a muzziness of the changed drug permeating her senses.
I could change that, she thought. I could take away the drug action and make it harmless.
But she sensed this would be an error.
I'm within a right of joining.
Then she knew what she had to do. Jessica opened her eyes, gestured to the water sack now being held above her by Chaney.
It has been blessed. Mingle the waters. Let the change come to all, that the people may partake and share in the blessing.
Let the catalyst do its work, she thought. Let the people drink of it and have their awareness of each other heightened for a while. The drug is safe now, now that a reverend mother has changed it.
Still, the demanding memory worked on her, thrusting. There was another thing she had to do, she realized, but the drug made it difficult to focus.
Ah, the old reverend mother.
I have met the reverend mother, Romalo. She is gone, but she remains. Let her memory be honored in the rite.
Now, where did I get those words?
Jessica wondered. And she realized they came from another memory, the life that had been given to her and now was part of herself. Something about that gift felt incomplete, though.
Let them have their orgy. They've little enough pleasure out of living. Yes. And you and I need this little time to become acquainted before I recede and pour out through your memories. Already, I feel myself being tied to bits of you. Ah, you've a mind filled with interesting things. So many things I'd never imagined.
And the memory mind encapsulated within her opened itself to Jessica, permitting a view down a wide corridor to other reverend mothers until there seemed no end to them. Jessica recoiled, fearing she would become lost in an ocean of oneness. Still, the corridor remained, revealing to Jessica that the Fremen culture was far older than she had suspected. There had been Fremen on Porotrin, she saw. A people grown soft with an easy planet, fair game for Imperial raiders to harvest and plant human colonies on Beleteguz and Salusa Secundus. Oh, the wailing Jessica sensed in that parting. Far down the corridor, an image voice screamed, "They denied us the Hajj!" Jessica saw the slave cribs on Beleteguz down that inner corridor, saw the weeding out and the selecting that spread men to Rossak and Harmonthap. Scenes of brutal ferocity opened to her like the petals of a terrible flower, and she saw the thread of the past carried by Sayedina after Sayedina, first by word of mouth hidden in the sand shanties, then refined through their own reverend mothers with the discovery of the poison drug on Rossak, and now developed to subtle strength on Arrakis, in the discovery of the water of life. Far down the inner corridor, another voice screamed, "Never to forgive! Never to forget!" But Jessica's attention was focused on the revelation of the water of life, seeing its source, the liquid exhalation of a dying sandworm, a maker. And as she saw the killing of it in her new memory, she suppressed a gasp.
The creature was drowned.
Mother, are you all right?
Paul's voice intruded on her, and Jessica struggled out of the inner awareness to stare up at him, conscious of duty to him but resenting his presence.
I'm like a person whose hands were kept numb, without sensation from the first moment of awareness, until one day the ability to feel is forced into them.
The thought hung in her mind, an enclosing awareness.
and I say, "Look, I have no hands." But the people all around me say, "What are hands?"
Are you all right?
Yes.
Is this all right for me to drink?
He gestured to the sack in Chaney's hands.
They want me to drink it.
She heard the hidden meaning in his words, realized he had detected the poison in the original unchanged substance, that he was concerned for her. It occurred to Jessica then to wonder about the limits of Paul's prescience. His question revealed much to her.
You may drink it. It has been changed.
And she looked beyond him to see Stilgar staring down at her, the dark, dark eyes studying.
No, we know you cannot be false.
She sensed hidden meaning here, too, but the muzziness of the drug was overpowering her senses. How warm it was, and soothing. How beneficent these Fremen to bring her into the fold of such companionship. Paul saw the drug take hold of his mother. He searched his memory, the fixed past, the flux lines of the possible futures. It was like scanning through arrested instants of time, disconcerting to the lens of the inner eye. The fragments were difficult to understand when snatched out of the flux. This drug, he could assemble knowledge about it, understand what it was doing to his mother, but the knowledge lacked a natural rhythm, lacked a system of mutual reflection. He realized suddenly that it was one thing to see the past occupying the present, but the true test of prescience was to see the past in the future. Things persisted in not being what they seemed.
Drink it.
Chaney waved the horn spout of a water sack under his nose. Paul straightened, staring at Chaney. He felt carnival excitement in the air. He knew what would happen if he drank this spice drug with its quintessence of the substance that brought the change onto him. He would return to the vision of pure time, of time become space. It would perch him on the dizzying summit and defy him to understand. From behind Chaney, Stilgar spoke.
Drink it, lad. You delay the rite.
Paul listened to the crowd then, hearing the wildness in their voices.
Lisan al-Gaib, they said. Muad'Dib!
He looked down at his mother. She appeared peacefully asleep, in a sitting position, her breathing even and deep. A phrase out of the future that was his lonely past came into his mind. She sleeps in the waters of life. Chaney tugged at his sleeve. Paul took the horn spout into his mouth, heard the people shout. He felt the liquid gush into his throat as Chaney pressed the sack, sensed giddiness in the fumes. Chaney removed the spout, handed the sack into hands that reached for it from the floor of the cavern. His eyes focused on her arm, the green band of mourning there. As she straightened, Chaney saw the direction of his gaze.
I can mourn him even in the happiness of the waters. This was something he gave us.
She put her hand into his, pulling him along the ledge.
We are alike in a thing, Usul. We have each lost a father to the Harkonnens.
Paul followed her. He felt that his head had been separated from his body and restored with odd connections. His legs were remote and rubbery. They entered a narrow side passage, its walls dimly lighted by spaced-out glow globes. Paul felt the drug beginning to have its unique effect on him, opening time like a flower. He found need to steady himself against Chaney as they turned through another shadowed tunnel. The mixture of whipcord and softness he felt beneath her robe stirred his blood. The sensation mingled with the work of the drug, folding future and past into the present, leaving him the thinnest margin of trinocular focus.
I know you, Chaney. We've sat upon a ledge above the sand while I soothed your fears. We've caressed in the dark of the CH. We've...
Paul found himself losing focus, tried to shake his head, stumbled. Chaney steadied him, led him through thick hangings into the yellow warmth of a private apartment, low tables, cushions, a sleeping pad beneath an orange spread. Paul grew aware that they had stopped, that Chaney stood facing him and that her eyes betrayed a look of quiet terror.
You must tell me.
You are Sihaya, the desert spring.
When the tribe shares the water, we're together. All of us. We share. I can sense the others with me, but I'm afraid to share with you.
Why?
He tried to focus on her, but past and future were merging into the present, blurring her image. He saw her in countless ways and positions and settings.
There's something frightening in you. When I took you away from the others, I did it because I could feel what the others wanted. You press on people. You make us see things.
What do you see?
Paul had forced himself to speak distinctly. She looked down at her hands.
I see a child in my arms. It's our child, yours and mine.
Cheney put a hand to her mouth.
How can I know every feature of you?
They've a little of the talent, his mind told him, but they suppress it because it terrifies. In a moment of clarity, he saw how Cheney was trembling.
What is it you want to say?
Usul.
You cannot back into the future.
A profound compassion for her swept through him. He pulled her against him, stroked her head.
Cheney. Cheney, don't fear.
Usul, help me.
As she spoke, he felt the drug complete its work within him, ripping away the curtains to let him see the distant grey turmoil of his future.
You're so quiet.
He held himself poised in the awareness, seeing time stretch out in its weird dimension, delicately balanced yet whirling, narrow yet spread like a net, gathering countless worlds and forces, a tight wire that he must walk, yet a teeter-totter on which he balanced. On one side he could see the Imperium, a Harkonnen called Fade Rauther who flashed toward him like a deadly blade, the Sarduka raging off their planet to spread pogrom on Arrakis, the Guild conniving and plotting, the Bene Gesserit with their scheme of selective breeding. They lay, massed like a thunderhead on his horizon, held back by no more than the Fremen and their Muad'Dib. The sleeping giant Fremen, poised for their wild crusade across the universe. Paul felt himself at the center, at the pivot, where the whole structure turned, walking a thin wire of peace with a measure of happiness, Cheney at his side. He could see it stretching ahead of him, a time of relative quiet in a hidden sietch, a moment of peace between periods of violence.
There's no other place for peace.
Usul, you're crying. Usul, my strength. Do you give moisture to the dead? To who's dead?
To ones not yet dead.
Then let them have their time of life.
He sensed through the drug fog how right she was. Pulled her against him with savage pressure.
Sihaya!
She put a palm against his cheek.
I'm no longer afraid, Usul. Look at me. I see what you see when you hold me thus.
What do you see?
I see us giving love to each other in a time of quiet between storms. It's what we were meant to do.
The drug had him again, and he thought, so many times you've given me comfort and forgetfulness. He felt anew the hyper-illumination with its high relief imagery of time, sensed his future becoming memories. The tender indignities of physical love, the sharing and communion of selves, the softness and the violence.
You're the strong one, Cheney. Stay with me.
Always.
And she kissed his cheek. Book 3. The Prophet.
No woman, no man, no child ever was deeply intimate with my father. The closest anyone ever came to casual camaraderie with the Padishah Emperor was the relationship offered by Count Hasmir Fenring, a companion from childhood. The measure of Count Fenring's friendship may be seen first in a positive thing. He allayed the Landsrod's suspicions after the Arrakis affair. It cost more than 1 billion solaris in spice bribes, so my mother said, and there were other gifts as well. Slave women, royal honors, and tokens of rank. The second major evidence of the Count's friendship was negative. He refused to kill a man even though it was within his capabilities, and my father commanded it. I will relate this presently. Count Fenring, a profile by the Princess Irulan.
The Baron Vladimir Harkonnen raged down the corridor from his private apartments, flitting through patches of late afternoon sunlight that poured down from high windows. He bobbed and twisted in his suspensers with violent movements. Past the private kitchen he stormed, past the library, past the small reception room and into the servants' antechamber where the evening relaxation already had set in. The guard captain, Iokhan Nefud, squatted on a divan across the chamber, the stupor of Semuta dullness in his flat face, the eerie wailing of Semuta music around him. His own court sat near to do his bidding.
Nefud!
The Baron roared. Men scrambled. Nefud stood, his face composed by the narcotic but with an overlay of paleness that told of his fear. The Semuta music had stopped.
My Lord Baron, Nefud said.
Only the drug kept the trembling out of his voice. The Baron scanned the faces around him, seeing the looks of frantic quiet in them. He returned his attention to Nefud and spoke in a silken tone.
How long have you been my guard, Captain Nefud?
Nefud swallowed. Since Arrakis, my lord. Almost 2 years.
And have you always anticipated dangers to my person?
Such has been my only desire, my lord.
Then where is Feyd Rotha?
The Baron roared. Nefud recoiled.
My lord?
You do not consider Feyd Rotha a danger to my person.
Again the voice was silken. Nefud wet his lips with his tongue. Some of the Semuta dullness left his eyes.
Feyd Rotha's in the slave quarters, my lord.
With the women again, eh?
The Baron trembled with the effort of suppressing anger.
Sire, it could be he's... Silence!
The Baron advanced another step into the antechamber, noting how the men moved back, clearing a subtle space around Nefud, dissociating themselves from the object of wrath.
Did I not command you to know precisely where the Nar Baron was at all times?
The Baron asked. He moved a step closer.
Did I not say to you that you were to know precisely what the Nar Baron was saying at all times? And to whom?
Another step.
Did I not say to you that you were to tell me whenever he went into the quarters of the slave women?
Nefud swallowed. Perspiration stood out on his forehead. The Baron held his voice flat, almost devoid of emphasis.
Did I not say these things to you?
Nefud nodded.
And did I not say to you that you were to check all slave boys sent to me, and that you were to do this yourself, personally?
Again Nefud nodded.
Did you, perchance, not see the blemish on the thigh of the one sent me this evening?
The Baron asked.
Is it possible, you...
Uncle!
The Baron whirled, stared at Feyd Rotha standing in the doorway. The presence of his nephew here, now, the look of hurry that the young man could not quite conceal, all revealed much. Feyd Rotha had his own spy system focused on the Baron.
There is a body in my chambers that I wish removed,
the Baron said, and he kept his hand at the projectile weapon beneath his robes, thankful that his shield was the best. Feyd Rotha glanced at two guardsmen against the right wall, nodded. The two detached themselves, scurried out the door and down the hall toward the Baron's apartments.
Those two, eh?
The Baron thought.
Ah, this young monster has much to learn yet about conspiracy. I presume you left matters peaceful in the slave quarters, Feyd,
the Baron said.
I've been playing Cheops with a slave master, Feyd Rotha said, and he thought, what has gone wrong? The boy we sent to my uncle has obviously been killed. But he was perfect for the job. Even Howarth couldn't have made a better choice. The boy was perfect.
Playing pyramid chess, the Baron said. How nice. Did you win?
Yes, Uncle.
And Feyd Rotha strove to contain his disquiet. The Baron snapped his fingers.
Nevhud, you wish to be restored to my good graces?
Sire, what have I done? Nevhud quavered.
That's unimportant now, the Baron said. Fade has beaten the slave master at Cheops. Did you hear that?
Yes, sire.
I wish you to take 3 men and go to the slave master, the Baron said. Garot, the slave master. Bring his body to me when you've finished, that I may see it was done properly. We cannot have such inept chess players in our employ.
Fade Rauther went pale, took a step forward.
But, uncle, I...
Later, Fade,
the Baron said and waved a hand.
Later.
The 2 guards who had gone to the Baron's quarters for the slave boy's body staggered past the antechamber door with their load sagging between them, arms trailing. The Baron watched until they were out of sight.
Nevhud stepped up beside the Baron.
You wish me to kill the slave master now, my lord?
Now, the Baron said. And when you've finished, add those 2 who just passed to your list. I don't like the way they carried that body. One should do such things neatly. I'll wish to see their carcasses, too.
Nevhud said, My lord, is it anything that I've...
Do as your master has ordered, Fade Rauther said. And he thought, All I can hope for now is to save my own skin.
Good, the Baron thought. He yet knows how to cut his losses. And the Baron smiled inwardly at himself, thinking... The lad knows, too, what will please me and be most apt to stay my wrath from falling on him. He knows I must preserve him. Who else do I have who could take the reins I must leave some day? I have no other as capable.
But he must learn, and I must preserve myself while he's learning.
Nevhud signaled men to assist him, led them out the door.
Would you accompany me to my chambers, Fade?
The Baron asked.
I am yours to command,
Fade Rauther said. He bowed, thinking, I'm caught.
After you, the Baron said,
and he gestured to the door. Fade Rauther indicated his fear by only the barest hesitation. Have I failed utterly? He asked himself. Will he slip a poisoned blade into my back, slowly, through the shield? Does he have an alternative successor?
Let him experience this moment of terror, the Baron thought, as he walked along behind his nephew. He will succeed me, but at a time of my choosing. I'll not have him throwing away what I've built.
Fade Rauther tried not to walk too swiftly. He felt the skin crawling on his back, as though his body itself wondered when the blow could come. His muscles alternately tensed and relaxed.
Have you heard the latest word from Arrakis? The Baron asked.
No, uncle.
Fade Rauther forced himself not to look back. He turned down the hall out of the servants' wing.
They've a new prophet or religious leader of some kind among the Fremen, the Baron said. They call him Muad'Dib. Very funny, really. It means the mouse. I've told Raban to let them have their religion. It'll keep them occupied.
That's very interesting, uncle, Fade Rauther said.
He turned into the private corridor to his uncle's quarters, wondering, why does he talk about religion? Is it some subtle hint to me?
Yes, isn't it? The Baron said.
They came into the Baron's apartments through the reception salon to the bedchamber. Subtle signs of a struggle greeted them here, a suspenser lamp displaced, a bed cushion on the floor, a soother reel spilled open across a bedstand.
It was a clever plan.
The Baron kept his body shield tuned to maximum, stopped, facing his nephew.
But not clever enough. Tell me, Fade, why didn't you strike me down yourself? You've had opportunity enough.
Fade Rauther found a suspensor chair, accomplished a mental shrug as he sat down in it without being asked.
I must be bold now, he thought.
You taught me that my own hands must remain clean.
Ah, yes. When you face the Emperor, you must be able to say truthfully, that you did not do the deed. The witch at the Emperor's elbow will hear your words and know their truth or falsehood. Yes, I warned you about that.
Why haven't you ever bought a Bene Gesserit, Uncle? With a truthsayer at your side...
You know my tastes.
Fade Rautha studied his uncle.
Still, one would be valuable for...
I trust them not. And stop trying to change the subject.
As you wish, Uncle.
I remember a time in the arena several years ago. It seemed there that day a slave had been set to kill you. Is that truly how it was?
It's been so long ago, Uncle. After all, I...
No evasions, please.
Fade Rautha looked at his uncle, thinking, he knows, else he wouldn't ask.
It was a sham, Uncle. I arranged it to discredit your slave master.
Very clever. Brave, too. That slave gladiator almost took you, didn't he?
Yes.
If you had finesse and subtlety to match such courage, you'd be truly formidable.
The Baron shook his head from side to side. As he had done many times since that terrible day on Arrakis, he found himself regretting the loss of Piter the Mentat. There'd been a man of delicate, devilish subtlety. It hadn't saved him, though. Again, the Baron shook his head. Fate was sometimes inscrutable. Fade Rautha glanced around the bedchamber, studying the signs of the struggle, wondering how his uncle had overcome the slave they'd prepared so carefully.
How did I best him? Ah, now, Fade, let me keep some weapons to preserve me in my old age. It's better we use this time to strike a bargain.
Fade Rautha stared at him.
A bargain? He means to keep me as his heir for certain, then. Else why bargain? One bargains with equals, or near equals.
What bargain, Uncle?
And Fade Rautha felt proud that his voice remained calm and reasonable, betraying none of the elation that filled him. The Baron, too, noted the control. He nodded.
You're good material, Fade. I don't waste good material. You persist, however, in refusing to learn my true value to you. You are obstinate. You do not see why I should be preserved as someone of the utmost value to you. This...
He gestured at the evidence of the struggle in the bedchamber.
This was foolishness. I do not reward foolishness.
Get to the point, you old fool, Fade Rautha thought.
You think of me as an old fool. I must dissuade you of that.
You speak of a bargain.
Ah, the impatience of youth. Well, this is the substance of it, then. You will cease these foolish attempts on my life, and I, when you are ready for it, will step aside in your favor. I will retire to an advisory position, leaving you in the seat of power.
Retire, Uncle?
You still think me the fool, and this but confirms it, eh? You think I'm begging you. Step cautiously, Fade. This old fool saw through the shielded needle you planted in that slave boy's thigh. Right where I'd put my hand on it, eh? The smallest pressure and... snick! A poison needle in the old fool's palm. Ah, Fade.
The Baron shook his head, thinking, it would have worked too if Howard hadn't warned me. Well, let the lad believe I saw the plot on my own. In a way, I did. I was the one who saved Howard from the wreckage of Arrakis, and this lad needs greater respect for my prowess. Fade Rautha remained silent, struggling with himself.
Is he being truthful? Does he really mean to retire? Why not? I'm sure to succeed him one day if I move carefully. He can't live forever. Perhaps it was foolish to try hurrying the process.
You speak of a bargain. What pledge do we give to bind it?
How can we trust each other, eh? Well, Fade, as for you, I'm setting Thufir Hawat to watch over you. I trust Hawat's Mentat capabilities in this. Do you understand me? And as for me, you'll have to take me on faith. But I can't live forever, can I, Fade? And perhaps you should begin to suspect now that there are things I know which you should know.
I give you my pledge. And what do you give me?
I let you go on living.
Again, Fade Rautha studied his uncle.
He sets Howard over me. What would he say if I told him Howard planned the trick with the gladiator that cost him his slave master? He'd likely say I was lying in the attempt to discredit Howard. No. The good Thufir is a Mentat,
and has anticipated this moment.
Well, what do you say?
What can I say? I accept, of course.
And Fade Rauther thought, Hawat, he plays both ends against the middle. Is that it? Has he moved to my uncle's camp because I didn't counsel with him over the slave boy attempt?
You haven't said anything about my setting Hawat to watch you.
Fade Rauther betrayed anger by a flaring of nostrils. The name of Hawat had been a danger signal in the Harkonnen family for so many years, and now it had a new meaning. Still dangerous.
Hawat's a dangerous toy.
Toy? Don't be stupid. I know what I have in Hawat, and how to control it. Hawat has deep emotions, Fade. The man without emotions is the one to fear, but deep emotions, now those can be bent to your needs.
Uncle, I don't understand you.
Yes, that's plain enough.
Only a flicker of eyelids betrayed the passage of resentment through Fade Rauther.
And you do not understand Hawat?
Nor do you, Fade Rauther thought.
Who does Hawat blame for his present circumstances? Me? Certainly. But he was an Atreides tool and bested me for years until the Imperium took a hand. That's how he sees it. His hate for me is a casual thing now. He believes he can best me any time. Believing this, he is bested. For I direct his attention where I want it, against the Imperium.
Tensions of a new understanding drew tight lines across Fade Rauther's forehead, thinned his mouth.
Against the Emperor?
Let my dear nephew try the taste of that, the Baron thought. Let him say to himself, the Emperor Fade Rauther Harkonnen. Let him ask himself how much that's worth. Surely it must be worth the life of one old uncle who could make that dream come to pass. Slowly Fade Rauther wet his lips with his tongue. Could it be true what the old fool was saying? There was more here than there seemed to be.
And what has Hawat to do with this?
He thinks he uses us to wreak his revenge upon the Emperor.
And when that's accomplished?
He does not think beyond his revenge. Hawat's a man who must serve others, and doesn't even know this about himself.
I've learned much from Hawat.
Fade Rauther felt the truth of the words as he spoke them.
But the more I learn, the more I feel we should dispose of him, and soon.
You don't like the idea of his watching you?
Hawat watches everybody.
And he may put you on a throne. Hawat is subtle, he is dangerous, devious. But I'll not yet withhold the antidote from him. A sword is dangerous too, Fade. We have the scabbard for this one, though. The poison's in him. When we withdraw the antidote, death will sheathe him.
In a way, it's like the arena. Feints within feints within feints. You watch to see which way the gladiator leans, which way he looks, how he holds his knife.
He nodded to himself, seeing that these words pleased his uncle, but thinking, yes, like the arena, and the cutting edge is the mind.
Now you see you need me. I'm yet of use, Fade.
A sword to be wielded until he's too blunt for use, Fade Rauther thought.
Yes, uncle.
And now we will go down to the slave quarters, we two, and I will watch while you, with your own hands, kill all the women in the pleasure wing.
Uncle!
There will be other women, Fade, but I have said that you do not make a mistake casually with me.
Fade Rauther's face darkened.
Uncle, you...
You will accept your punishment and learn something from it.
Fade Rauther met the gloating stare in his uncle's eyes. And I must remember this night, he thought. And remembering it, I must remember other nights.
You will not refuse.
What could you do if I refused, old man? Fade Rauther asked himself. But he knew there might be some other punishment, perhaps a more subtle one, a more brutal lever to bend him.
I know you, Fade. You will not refuse.
All right, Fade Rauther thought. I need you now, I see that. The bargain's made. But I'll not always need you. And someday...
Deep in the human unconscious is a pervasive need for a logical universe that makes sense. But the real universe is always one step beyond logic. From Sayings of the Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
I've sat across from many rulers of great houses, but never seen a more gross and dangerous pig than this one, Thufir Hawat told himself.
You may speak plainly with me, Hawat,
the Baron rumbled. He leaned back in his suspensor chair, the eyes in their folds of fat boring into Hawat. The old Mentat looked down at the table between him and the Baron Vladimir.